ridiculously kind introduction. I'll get straight into it, and I know you must have festival fatigue, so just so you know what you're in for, I've timed this talk and it will not go over 40 minutes, so if you're looking at your watch, you can count down to that. The talk is called The Unsafe Space of Literature. And I had a great deal of trouble working out how to begin this speech on three consecutive nights. I woke up after midnight thinking that I finally had the brilliant idea and thinking that I didn't have to get out of bed and I didn't have to write down any notes because there was no way I would forget that brilliant idea. And you're laughing because you know what happened, don't you? When I woke up on each of those three consecutive mornings, I'd forgotten absolutely everything. So I had to do the hard work of writing this without any help from the muse. One of the problems that I had with writing this closing speech is that the older I get, the more I think I really don't know much at all. Of course, propriety requires that I speak with authority today, as if I do in fact know something. But unfortunately, I'm not particularly good with propriety or authority, a quality of mine, I am the first to admit, is a little on the puerile side. And I think it's something I inherited from my father, whose memorable response to viewing a pristine, white-sheeted bed, can you picture it, on the TV show Better Homes and Gardens, was to say, "That bed makes me want to shit on it." I need an explanation. My father is Finnish. Breed of humans are notorious for their rare but blunt locutions. Finns are well known for their reticence despite speaking Finnish, Swedish and English. And Bertolt Brecht once memorably said that a Finn is someone who says nothing in three languages. My father was actually a concrete formworker by trade, and whatever English words he did speak were typically those of the building site, so I think that offers another explanation. Of course, whether we like it or not, our parents are our defining role models. We become ourselves in an intersubjective art environment in which their personalities dominate. This might be even more intensely the case in the hothouse environments of isolated migrant families like the one in which I grew up in the 70s and 80s in Melbourne. And I hope this offers some explanation of what I'm about to confess, which is that I have come to the somewhat embarrassing realisation that my father's urge to defecate on a pristine bed resonates with my creative practice. In fact, it has now become my considered belief, and please continue to excuse my father's French, that if we as writers and readers don't regularly shit on things, literary culture will become as stylized, self-important, performative and inane as Better Homes and Gardens. I didn't expect that one to get a laugh, but anyway. The Italian visual artist Piero Manzoni's notorious cans of artist shit express this point much more succinctly than I have. The rebellious surrealists also give me illustrious precursors to fall back on. One of my favourite writerly quotes comes from André Breton's 1925 Surrealist Manifesto, in which he describes the surrealist mission in a way that has nothing to do with shit, those sensitive souls amongst you will be very pleased to hear, but which represents a certain spirit of destructiveness and boldness that has always made sense to me as a writer. So the surrealists were interested in undermining the authority of rationality, of the idea that we are rational human beings rationally going about our lives. They pointed instead to the psyche and the body, and the profound effects they have on how we understand things. In the Surrealist Manifesto, Breton writes, "We intend to show the fragility of thought and on what shifting foundations, what caverns we have built our trembling houses." Of course, the producers of Better Homes and Gardens would have been horrified at the potential damage to real estate, but the quote has always resounded with me as a reader and writer who is interested in looking beyond a vision of the world as it is marketed to us, in being suspicious of rationality but also the ease of sentimentality, in plumbing the abyss of strangeness that lies within each of us. Inspired by feminist writers, I have also delighted in revealing the fragility of class structures and patriarchy, in unsettling the house of masculine privilege and authority, in refusing roles laid out for me as a woman, in asserting that the mysteries of reality are up for grabs for me as much as anyone else. The Surrealists were very influenced by the inventor of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud, who unfortunately did not return their esteem, and Freud memorably described the Surrealists as, quote, 100% fools, or let's rather say, as with alcohol, 95%. And it's no surprise to me that the anarchic energies of the Surrealists were rejected by a man who was pathologically and destructively committed to his own knowledge and authority, even to the extent, as feminist critics of Freud have shown, that it blinded him to flaws in his own theories of reality. In fact, what Freud teaches us is that belief in one's authority can be a profound obstacle to genuine knowledge and insight. He teaches us that we should always be prepared to second-guess ourselves. And that is what I want to do today. I want to interrogate my authority as a writer. I want to question what it is that I do as a writer with an agenda that I have comically and benignly described as puerile, but which one might more honestly call violent and violating. So at its most grandiose, literature is viewed as morally uplifting, as an empathy enhancer, as a social good in and of itself. The public particularly likes books, such as To Kill a Mockingbird, that wear their moral heart on their sleeve. Literature is also evidence of a civilised identity, one that is bound up with wealth and class and visions of a refined and superior sensibility. I'm not going to argue against the importance of books, and as a child of migrant working class parents, I'm certainly not going to argue that I have been oppressed by literature. When I was growing up, we had three books in our house, all in Finnish. There was my mother's Arpinen, or school primer, a vividly green picture book called Mitä kello on, or What Time Is It?, and a short children's novel about a cat called Becca Döpähäntä. And when I learned English at primary school and found myself with access to the wonders of a school library, my childhood world, which had been so contained, so claustrophobic, expanded exponentially. What I am going to question, though, is a sentimental vision of what my learning journey through literature was like. My experience of books from my childhood through to my adulthood included experiences of escape and comfort and humour, absolutely, but it was also punctuated by shocks, traumas and awakenings, by occasions that pushed me to reinterpret myself and my world, by reading events that broke me apart and remade me anew. And what I want to question more specifically is the mindset of the writers who did that to me, and the mindset of myself as a writer now, which I introduce to you as one marked by destructiveness. So writers may have the reputation of being agents of moral improvement, but writers talk about themselves and their writing quite differently. I've read many interviews with writers over the last month or so in doing research for this talk, and I have not come across any writers who presented themselves as moral leaders working for the greater good. I've also thought deeply about books and their effects on me, and what I have begun to conclude is this. Many writers are sadomasochists who appear compelled to strip the reader of comfort and complacency after they have stripped themselves of it first. These writers might say that they are simply committed to the truth, but I think the truth is this. Such writers are on a brutal quest to shock the reader, to scar their truth into the reader's soul, to achieve immortality by carving their way into a stranger's memory. We see this urge to wound, to violate, to affect, to transform, play out in different ways in the work that certain writers offer up to us. Think of Kafka's The Metamorphosis, James Coetzee's Disgrace, Cormac McCarthy's The Road, Toni Morrison's Beloved, Sophie Laguna's 1 Foot Wrong, Helen Garner's The Spare Room, Ali Smith's Hotel World, Elizabeth Strout's My Name is Lucy Barton. The list might go on and on, and it would include work by writers in this room. These writers give us stories of alienation, sordid intimacy, suffering, incomprehension, meaninglessness, apocalypse, grief. For William Faulkner, the writer is energised by a diabolical spirit. Faulkner pontificates, and he was quite good at doing that. And it's such a shame that I can't do his southern accent, but it's quite a long quote, but I won't even try it. An artist is a creature driven by demons. He doesn't know why they choose him, and he's usually too busy to wonder why. He is completely amoral in that he will rob, borrow, beg or steal from anybody and everybody to get the work done. So here Faulkner basically gives writers a free pass for being freeloaders, given that they are the victims of demons, no less, that compel them to put writing ahead of being a good human being. Certainly Faulkner is contemptuous of the idea that writers might be motivated by financial gain. For Faulkner, the prize of writing is something greater. It is a kind of power which he figures in violently masculinist and misogynistic terms. He preaches, the writer doesn't need economic freedom. All he needs is a pencil and some paper. Good ones don't have time to bother with success or getting rich. Success is feminine and like a woman. If you cringe before her, she will override you. So the way to treat her is to show her the back of your hand. Then maybe she will do the crawling. At an obvious level, Faulkner's posturing and rhetoric add up to a whole lot of offensive rubbish. And yet, women writers have also recognised a motivation beyond economic gain. In fact, some have, like their male counterparts, intimated at the violence that lies behind what they do with the pen and page, or keyboard and screen, and the ways in which power is implicated in creative writing. Joan Didion, in the bold style that defines her work, describes writing as inherently hostile. She explains, again, I can't do accents, you're trying to make somebody see something the way you see it, trying to impose your idea, your picture. It's hostile to try to wrench around somebody else's mind that way. Ali Smith is likewise blunt about what she offers her readers. She asks, do you come to art to be comforted, or do you come to art to be reskinned? Personally, I don't see why readers can't come to literature for both. A book can legitimately give a reader comfort. Think of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. However, like Ali Smith, the literature I am interested in here is the kind that leaves you skinned, the kind that leaves you feeling raw, because this is precisely the effect that I, as a writer, have wanted to have. And I also know, after attending Jennifer Down's session this morning, that I am definitely not alone. She's very happy if her stories leave you feeling sick or as if you have been punched in the gut. And in fact, that's what I come to Jennifer's stories for, that impact. But how can we see this aim other than as Faulkner does, as fundamentally, profoundly diabolical, as a sadistic kind of power play? Glad we're in this together, Jennifer. Thanks for that. I have an autobiographical story that I'd like to share with you in relation to my development as a writer of diabolical agendas. When I was a child, I feared that I was the Antichrist.
This is true.
I used to check for the mark of the devil on my scalp. I would stand up close to the bathroom mirror with a small mirror in my hand so that I could inspect the back of my head. I was searching my scalp for a tattoo of the number of the beast, 666. Again, I realise this needs a bit of explaining. To start with, I watched horror films from an early age. My family got a VHS video player. Remember those? Some people in the room. When I was in primary school, and for whatever reason, visits to the video rental store, again, remember those? Saw my father choose video cassettes featuring images of horror behind the sticky plastic of their protective covers. These videos included what are now classics of the horror genre: The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Exorcist, A Nightmare on Elm Street. We would have watched every available horror film in the store. Looking back, I can identify two films that were responsible for my childhood anxiety about being the Antichrist. Pardon me. The Omen and its sequel, Damien Omen 2. These films were about an adopted boy who comes to a reluctant awareness that he was spawned by the devil and who is able to confirm this by identifying the mark of the devil beneath his hair. I should probably also explain that I had been brought up in the Lutheran religion, so that the idea of a devil's child struck me as perfectly feasible. In fact, I would go so far as to say that the supernatural realm of horror and of Christianity formed pretty much a single spectrum for me. One might view my identification with the devil child in the Omen films as unfortunate and perhaps masochistic, but I suspect that an identification with the parade of savaged, screaming female victims in horror films would have been infinitely worse. In fact, the way I see it, the character of the devil child unconsciously represented for my childish self a transgressive fantasy of power. To begin with, he embodied the fantasy of being adopted and therefore autonomous. Damien's capacity to supernaturally harm his enemies was also very attractive. Vicious Dobermans, nasty ravens, and spontaneous aneurysms would befall those who had done him wrong. And as a child who was bullied for speaking a foreign language, for having a weird name, for liking my own company, in short, for being different, the potential to wreak vengeance had a definite appeal. It was also the case that there was someone devastatingly powerful looking after Damien, who stood to inherit nothing less than the earth. So there I was, the timid daughter of Finnish migrants, harbouring fantasies of omnipotence and being terrified of them. We expect young girls to be as innocuous and innocent as possible, though we encourage young boys' fantasies of power through superhero stories and football stars. But I imagine that all female children, or indeed grown women, would uncover in themselves a diabolical desire for power from time to time. In fact, it has always struck me that Sylvia Plath's poetry expresses a demonic fantasy of supremacy. When I was introduced to her poetry in my high school literature class, I was instantly mesmerised. The last lines of Lady Lazarus are embedded in my memory. Her God, her Lucifer, beware, beware. Out of the ash I rise with my red hair and I eat men like air. I read and wrote a lot in high school, but the practice started in primary school. Perhaps not surprisingly, the first stories I wrote were in the horror genre. I wrote them with a desire to defy what was expected of me and with the intense pleasure of a child who knows they are being naughty. One story called Maniac, the heading dripping with red text art, told the story of a young girl who comes home from school one day to find her mother being carved up by a serial killer. The girl flees to the police station, and the police put the child in a hotel I think I had conceived of as a kind of safe house. That evening, the girl looks out of her hotel room window and sees her dog being decapitated by the killer, now wielding a saw in the hotel car park. Sometime after submitting this story to my teacher,